Hey guys, do you like basketball? 'Cause I like basketball. What's up, Internet? This is the Rary is Fundamental Podcast, episode 87, recorded May 18, 2018, brought to you by Rary.net. My name is Rary. And you heard that from the beginning, right? Like, I said I like basketball. Well, because if you do like basketball, well, you should have known that the WNBA season started tonight. The Phoenix Mercury beat the Dallas Wings 86-78. So yeah, this WNBA season has started. I couldn't be happier because that'll be, see, I'm a casual WNBA watcher, and people know that, right? Like, I'm not a religious watcher, but I know stuff about them. And this season, I intend to be more than just a casual watcher because, I mean, come on, it is basketball, right? So, whether it's man or woman or handicap or dog, if it's basketball, it's basketball. I'm going to watch it. And I think it's because I gained more of an appreciation of this when I watched the G League. And I had a blast covering the G League this season, the South Bay Lakers. It really made me appreciate the game even more. And it's not because, you know, it's not because I hated the WNBA. I still watched it, right? Or the G League. I will watch basketball if it's on. That's not a question. It's more of like getting away from the NBA coverage that I was so afraid of, right? And now it's like I haven't been writing as much about the NBA, but I do talk about it on podcasts, and I decided, hey, you know what? I should give more time to the G League. I should give more time to the WNBA, and maybe, you know, down the line, college basketball, which I used to be religiously into in the mid 90s or so. I still do watch the tournaments, though, so it's not like I turn away from it completely. But yeah, so, you know, if you like basketball, give the WNBA a shot. It's really good. Like, it's better than it's ever been, really. And, you know, there's a lot of talent. You should give it a shot. In the meantime, for this episode, yeah, we're sticking to basketball. Because, again, we like basketball. I'm talking to Ben Golliver of Sports Illustrated and the Open Floor Podcast. Also, formerly from Blazers Edge, one of my oldest friends in the NBA Twitterverse. And we're going to talk about the playoffs, the Final Four of the NBA playoffs, of the Cavs against the Celtics and the Warriors against the Rockets, and also questioning the referees' calls and the draft lottery that just happened. The Phoenix Suns are getting the number one pick, and should they change the system? I know they're changing it for next season, although it's kind of like more of a modest change, not a drastic change. So we're going to talk about all of that. But before we get to Ben, just let me remind you, you can subscribe to this podcast on Stitcher. Download on Stitcher, really. iTunes, oh god, you're always so broken. Anyway, any podcast app that will do, you know, you can find Rary's Fundamental right there. Also, you can find the podcast on its home site, rary.net/fun. And follow me on Twitter at the Nolog Pass. Follow the podcast Twitter at Rary is Fun. That is it. I'm out of breath. Here's Ben Golliver. We're talking playoffs.
It's Jasmine Brown, and you're listening to the Rary is Fundamental Podcast.
Rary is Fundamental Podcast, episode 87, recorded May 18, 2018. My guest from Sports Illustrated, Open Floor Podcast, and of course, formerly from Blazers Edge, my old friend. How's it going, man?
It's going very well, Rary. It's an old school issue. I mean, the last time we talked was probably, what, 4 or 5 years ago, I feel like, for your podcast? I mean, you've been going for a while.
Yeah, it's obviously rebranded now, but yeah, it was 5 years ago, and it's funny because, like, one of my questions involves, like, the referees, basically, and I was like, I wanted to go over that one from what we talked about 5 years ago, because might as well talk about it now, right? Because we mentioned transparency and instant replay and the last 2 minute reports, everything. Like, has it changed? You think it's improved at all? And any...
Yeah, no, I think a lot of the same questions that there were probably existing 5 years ago would exist today. I think because there's been so many 2-minute reports, I think you have a little bit of the backlash to those now. So people have kind of dug in and said, hey, those don't really solve any problems. And while they provide a level of transparency, they all provide a lot of hurt feelings because you have an entire fan base in an organization that looks back on that call and thinks, you know, you admitted you were wrong, but, you know, you couldn't do anything to fix it. So now they're just even angrier. I think I probably thought at that time, or at least I hoped, that the transparency level would help to calm some of those fears and it would at least be an official acknowledgement.
Right.
But it really hasn't worked out that way. And my biggest concern here over the last 12 months is the animosity between the referees and, you know, the various players and so forth on Twitter. I mean, the official referees accounts, like, constantly kind of contradicting various reports here and there of different calls and explanations and trying to stand up for the referees. And you understand why they want to do that. They want to advocate for their guys. But it just makes a complicated, you know, picture even more complicated. So I think it is something that maybe Adam Silver and the competition committee and those guys over the summer should look at again, because you don't want to have, you know, a bad call made worse by the kind of stuff that's happening on the internet after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mentioned 4 or 5 years ago that it's basically like getting caught, you know, getting a cookie from the cookie jar and getting, you know, you'll get any repercussions for it. Pretty much still the same thing. But the thing is, it's like, these referees are the best in the world. We can't get any better than that, right? I mean, it's hard to officiate a game. I mean, I should know. I mean, rec league refs kind of suck. So, like, yeah, like, any solutions to that? Really? Like, there's not much we can do, right?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is, you know, build up their stable. You know, you've seen a lot of the older referees retire in recent years. And what they're trying to do is create this program where they can develop referees and, you know, build them up. And as you look, even like the D-League, now the G-League is becoming more prominent for players. And certainly, you know, they're probably trying to do the same thing with the referees in terms of having a little bit of a farm system to sort of, you know, build these guys up. But when I look at the playoffs, I'm not sure that's been the biggest story of these playoffs. You know, how many controversial calls have really been, you know, ruining a game, say, one way or another? I think in a lot of cases, the players are able to decide the action. You look at the Western Conference Finals, you know, Draymond gets that early technical. That was a recall. He was chippy and talking, you know, chirping throughout the rest of that game. They never threw him out, and I thought that was the right decision. I didn't think he really went over the line. You know, you look at that J.R. Smith flagrant foul. I think you could, you know, argue in the Eastern Conference Finals, you know, maybe that should have been an ejection or something worse than what they gave him, but you know, aside from a few nitpicks here and there, I think they've been doing an okay job on a tough stage and, you know, in a big time way. And maybe the fact that the league is so top heavy, you know, in terms of all the teams we expected to make the conference final start of the year wound up making it, that might make their job easier. You know, if you're looking at 20-point blowouts or even just 10-point, 15-point games on a pretty regular basis because, you know, some of these juggernaut teams, especially like the Warriors and the Rockets, who both really cruised to that Western Conference Finals, they take some of the pressure off the referees, don't they? I mean, if you're not getting into those tight late game situations, you know, we're not necessarily analyzing, you know, every last, you know, Scott Foster decision because, you know, KD's going off for 35 and the Warriors are running away with the victory.
Yeah, and 95% of the calls are correct. They're just these ones that stand out, like the LeBron goaltending. But even then, it's like one out of like how many calls, right? So they just kind of stand out because they quote decide the game or whatever. So, I mean, I think they do a good job. I don't really complain about the refs too much, but sometimes there are just these obvious calls that they miss. You know what I mean? So, what can I say?
Yeah, no, I mean, they're never going to be perfect, and I think some of it's just about managing expectations. The other thing that I think is an interesting referee development, I don't know how interested you are in virtual reality, but I've watched a couple games with those VR headsets, you know, and I've talked to various people around the league who are kind of in charge of that, mm-hmm. you know, virtuality movement, because they're really trying to ramp up the broadcasts. And, you know, they have full broadcasts for these Western Conference Finals games that you can watch. Basically, you're sitting like right behind the basket and you can watch how these guys play. And, you know, what they're thinking is potentially, you know, 5 years down the road is instead of the referee walking over to that monitor, you know, trying to look at the courtside monitor and communicate with the people back in Secaucus and, you know, the whole process they have right now for reviewing plays during games, you know, potentially what they'd be able to do in the future is the referee would come over with the headset on and he'd be able to sort of watch the play from any angle to get the exact right, you know, virtual reality replay of the call in question. So, you know, is it a block, a charge? you know, what goaltending, was it a block, you know, all these different things that they would, you know, usually have to make these 50-50 decisions on, they could potentially use that technology to help them do it. And I'm all for that. I think it'd be really cool and really futuristic. You know, what they're able to do with sort of the camera angles, it's already better in virtual reality than it is on like the main broadcast, like TNT or ESPN, where they have tons of angles, but they don't have every angle. And, you know, that's the kind of cool thing about the panoramics they use for virtual reality is they can give you just about any angle you would want on any given play. And I think that's something to watch for the long term. You know, if we do this podcast again, you know, 5 years down the road, you know, that could be the type of thing where that's just commonplace. I think that'd be cool.
Well, we had these and we're up to three. How's it taking so long to get four referees or maybe even five just to have more eyes on the game?
Yeah, I mean, I think you run into the old, like, there's too many cooks in the kitchen problem there, right? Because they have been trained from a very early age to kind of divide up the court. And, you know, you take these types of calls when you're in this spot and what you're looking for. Here's who looks at the clock and all of that. If you do add the extra referee, you know, yes, you might be able to have, you know, one more set of eyes like you're mentioning. But I think you'd also have even more conflicts. And when you're looking at, say, player backing down another player in the post, you don't want those kinds of conflicts, like, you know, did he, you know, commit a defensive foul during the back down, or was it a charge, or did he try to pull the chair? I mean, you don't want to have these referees sort of like fighting over calls, and you don't also don't want over whistling. Like, I don't know about you, but basketball is the best when it kind of gets to that soccer style, right, where it's up and down, and that's what's so fun about, like, you know, the Rockets and the Warriors when they go to these small lineups and they're just running up and down the court, the ball, you know, really, you know, hopping around the perimeter. All these different guys can put the ball in the deck, go one-on-one. All these guys can shoot. You know, they're constantly swinging, so you just see all this free movement. I mean, it's really, really pretty. I mean, that's the pace and space that everybody talks about. You know, you throw more refs out there, my big concern would be that's just more whistles. And, you know, one thing we know is fans don't pay to watch the referees, right? So yeah. I think we're okay here with three.
Okay. Well, let's go to the East really quick. Boston, Cleveland's, I mean, Boston's up 2-0. Are you surprised what Boston is doing? They're missing their top two players, they're having injuries, and they're 2 wins away from the NBA Finals.
Yeah, no, it's really incredible. I mean, it's all about, you know, system, team, smart coaching, and steadiness for the Celtics. I think I was really impressed in game two because LeBron comes out with a vengeance, right? I mean, he puts up 21 in the first quarter, and against a lot of teams, that would be the haymaker that just does them in. You know, like, for example, the Raptors. If LeBron came out and scored 20 points against the Raptors in the first quarter, they might fire their coach at halftime, and DeMar DeRozan might quit halfway through the third quarter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those are kind of like back-breaking type scoring explosions from LeBron. Did you see the Celtics, you know, shrink from that moment or flinch at all? No, and they played sort of like the big cliche for the Warriors right now, which is sort of like the 48-minute game, you know. Golden State's always talking about this, how they want to just remain steady. They don't care if they get down by 10 points or up by 10 points. They just want to keep kind of playing almost like an assembly line machine. That's what we saw from Boston. I mean, they just stuck with it. And eventually Cleveland's defensive mistakes, you know, really caught up with them. You know, coming into these playoffs, you know, I was pretty nervous about the Cavaliers, how they were going to do, just because they hadn't played tons of minutes together. So many guys had been injured, all the trades and so on and so forth. And they were sort of waiting for a team to exploit that. Indiana pushed them a little bit in that regard, but what Boston's realized that, like, you can have sort of average or slightly above average offensive players, and I think that's sort of where their talent is right now, given the injury that you mentioned. But those guys can look like great offensive players if you continually put them in situations where they can succeed by generating high percentage shots. And that's exactly what the Celtics have done. I mean, they move the ball very well. They are very opportunistic in terms of pushing and transition. Cleveland's transition defense has just been pathetic. I mean, terrible. They don't match up very well. They're leaving guys wide open threes, and guys who are not completely fully formed players, you know, the Jaylen Browns and the Jason Tatums in the world, can look like, you know, borderline in this series because of the defense of last Cleveland. So I'm not writing the Cavaliers off. I think they're going to be able to respond, and, you know, home court should definitely help their role players a little bit, but if you look at spirit, togetherness, and, you know, all those, like, you know, old coaching cliches, you know, the John Wooden style cliches, the things that you should look for in basketball, that's exactly what the Celtics exemplify right now. They've been fun to watch.
Hey, what's up? This is Blake Murphy from Raptors Republic and a bunch of other places. You're listening to the Ray Ray is Fundamental podcast.
With that said, is this the most impressive LeBron James has ever been? Because, I mean, he's had two different teams this season, and he's basically nearly carried the entire team to the East Finals.
Yeah, well, the tricky part is, you know, LeBron's sort of like the super high-end wine where, like, you know, the aficionados, they argue, like, was, like, the 1992 vintage better than the 93 vintage? Or, you know, if you go you go to a museum and you see, like, 10 Picassos lined up, and you could stand there arguing with your buddies all day long, like, what's the best Picasso painting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, what we're seeing from LeBron, it's a lot like the 2015 LeBron, where he just has to do everything. I think he's as smart in terms of his basketball IQ and being able to do what he wants as he's ever been. Obviously, the numbers are just stupid. I mean, a 40-point 40-point triple-double is crazy. But, you know, defensively, he's part of their problem, right? I mean, he really is. If you look at some of their breakdowns in Game 2, it's him not having the energy or not having the wherewithal to race out to three-point shooters and to make those extra rotations. He's trying to, you know, conserve his energy and so forth. And that's a real factor. I'm not saying he's over the hill. I'm not saying he's falling off a cliff or anything like that. But, you know, when we look at the full picture, you know, physically, even though LeBron is so dominant offensively, you know, I think that, you know, teams are succeeding in pushing him in ways maybe that they couldn't have pushed him physically a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. So, because this is NBA Twitter, we see outrageous things being said. Is there a possibility Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward could be traded because of Terry Rozier and Jason Tatum rising up to challenge these playoffs? I mean, I even see, formerly from ESPN, Coach David Thorpe bandy this deal. Like, oh, let's trade Hayward and Irving for these guys or something. I'm like, wow, that's big.
Yeah, well, I mean, my general take is the fact that they could even consider doing something like that just shows you what of an embarrassment of riches that they have on hand, not mm-hmm. only in terms of talent, the draft picks that they've had over these last couple of years. And I think eventually they're going to have to make some choices, but I would find it hard to believe they would trade either one of those guys, you know, right, before really giving them a chance in the playoffs, you know, heading into next season. But the emergence of Tatum gives them some just unbelievable lineup combinations that they can play going forward. I mean, everybody wants to play interchangeably and, you know, be able to switch everything and have lots of different playmakers. And, you know, you look at Boston, I mean, their lineup combinations they can throw out there with, say, Kyrie, you know, Brown, Tatum, and Hayward, and throw on top of versatile centers in the league and Horford. And that is a truly, truly killer lineup. And I think they're going to be very active in trade talks in general just because they have so many assets, like we mentioned. And, you know, I think a guy like Rozier, the timing might be right to all high on him because, if I was a team – you know, in like Orlando or Phoenix that has just really missed a point guard presence over the last few years, maybe even the New York Knicks, you know, that type of team, I would be very interested in grabbing Terry Rozier because he's young, he's proven it in the playoffs, he's very skilled, he's got a great work ethic, and he's coming up where, you know, you can give him a contract extension, you can lock him in place as sort of your point guard for the future for the next, say, 5 years, and that's a tempting situation. So, you know, I think I'm trading Rozier and keeping Kyrie than the other way around.
I wonder if Phoenix would be open to trading the number one pick for Rozier. I just got a notification that ESPN's Woj said that Phoenix is open to trading the number one pick. I'm like, wow, okay.
I mean, I think that'd probably be overpaying for a guy like Rozier because, I think the talent right in the top year's draft seems pretty good, but... Mm-hmm. You know, what Phoenix try to do is, like, if they really want to draft Doncic, you know, the connection between their coach and him, and, you know, you could find a situation where maybe, sort of like last year, remember when Philadelphia traded up to get Markelle Fultz a couple spots?
Right.
Could you see a situation where, you know, maybe a team with, like, this, you know, the second or the third or the fourth pick just really wants to get DeAndre Ayton, and maybe Phoenix can figure out a way to add an extra draft pick or to kind of, you know, get another asset out of it? And still find a way to draft Doncic. You know, that could be a situation. But look, Phoenix has been so bad for so long, take any option off the table. So they should absolutely be open to trading that number one pick. They should listen to offers. And if they don't like what they're doing, they should be ready to draft, you know, Ayton or Doncic or whoever they believe is going to be the guy who can, you know, finally help them build some positive momentum.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to the lottery in a bit. But let's go to the West. You're in Oakland right now. Have you talked to the Warriors about how Stephen Curry is doing? Because he, you know, people have speculated that he could be hurt. But I mean, they do have four All-Stars after all. I mean, they're going to be okay. But I mean, Curry's still the guy.
Yeah, well, and they're going against a team that's got multiple All-Stars, so it's not a given that they're going to be okay, right? Like, if you take Curry out of this mix, something like Game 2 can happen, where the Golden State's offense bogs down, everything goes on Kevin Durant's shoulders, and they wind up losing that game going away. No, I think Golden State was doing their practice, trying to brush off the Steph talk and just basically say, hey, look, he's still trying to get his rhythm back. You know, he missed a lot of time with a knee injury. But they were saying repeatedly, and he's in health-wise, I think they don't want to make that excuse. But, you know, after game one down in Houston, Steph Curry kind of admitted that, you know, there was something going wrong. Maybe he got a tweak or something, and that he was trying to sort of play through it. He was hoping it wouldn't sideline him. So I don't think it's a coincidence that he's missing all these shots. I mean, Steph Curry is like the most bankable shooter in the entire league, and you know, he winds up going for 8 from 3s. I mean, that seems like a, you know, a real anomaly from him. So yeah, I'm watching his health closely, and we'll see do. But we should give the Rockets a lot of credit. They're putting tons of defensive pressure on him. You know, they're attacking him relentlessly. You know, he's doing a pretty good job of defending, but you can only do so much when you're his size. You know, if guys are taking you off the dribble towards a basket, it's very hard for him to, you know, play physically or block shots or anything like that. And so, you know, he's just had a very smart game plan in terms of attacking him, and it's really worked out for them.
They look great in game two, but do the Rockets face any extra pressure being losing the home court advantage? I mean, after all, they're most of the Western Conference Finals. Do you see them possibly, I don't know, melting down at the end of the series, maybe? I mean, we've seen this before. We've seen the Kings, like, melt down in 2002 in Game 7, so I'm kind of, like, curious about that.
Yeah, I don't know if the meltdown is the right word, but I could see a situation where a lot of those players who really stepped up in Game 2, you know, P.J. Tucker and Ariza and all those guys, it can be a lot harder for those guys to deliver and to really play great basketball on the road, and I think that would be my concern if I was going to Oracle. It's going to be absolutely crazy if Steph is able to, you know, get back on track. With his shot, you know, we could easily be in a situation after game four where, you know, Golden State's leading 3-1 and, you know, it's just sort of a matter of, you know, can Houston force a game six? But look, I don't think there's any shame in that. Obviously, this Golden State team is really, really good. Houston's had an incredible season start to finish. And if they're able to push Golden State to, say, 6 games, I mean, I'm not huge on moral victories, but that would almost count as a moral victory, because if you go back and look at how the other teams have played against Golden State since they got Kevin Durant, nobody's pushed them to game six in a playoff series. It just hasn't happened. It's been all 5 games or sweeps. So I think, unfortunately, when you have a team that's as good as Golden State, the standards, you know, and the way you frame a series starts to change a little bit.
Had the playoff at least been more compelling to you this year than last year, because Golden State and Cleveland just ran over their conferences, and Golden State only lost one game.
No doubt. We had some great first-round series, and it was nice and fresh blood in there, too. You know, some of these guys, like we mentioned Roger earlier, but talents, some of the other guys, Donovan Mitchell, obviously, and Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid. I mean, how nice is it to have that much talent, that many new faces in the postseason all simultaneously for the first time? You know, this year, I guess, first time in a big way for a guy like Rozier. Some of those other guys were there, you know, they were making their playoff debuts, but I loved it. I mean, I thought there was a lot of drama in the early rounds. Some great storylines in Philadelphia sort of arriving before teams, or a lot of observers and fans maybe thought that they would arrive in terms of winning a playoff series and going deep. So, you know, from that standpoint, I think they've been a great playoffs, but to be honest, I'm kind of the wrong guy to ask, because I love the NBA so much. I love playoff basketball so much that they could be terrible series. They could all be sweeps. They could be bad basketball. And I'd probably still be over here telling you how great it was.
Yeah, I'm the same way too. Like, I'll watch regardless, right? So, last thing, the lottery. We go to a different way to system next season. 3 worst teams now have the same odds, and we're going to get 4 teams instead of 3 drawn for the lottery. Better than,
yeah,
than
I
this
think,
current
I,
system, you think?
I think so. It's a pretty modest change, and when you look at the lottery, I mean, now Adam Silver come away as the biggest loser from the lottery draft night, because the number one tank team this year, which was Phoenix, you know, they're resting Devin Booker at various points down the stretch. They fired their coach the first pick of the season. I mean, they were just an utter disaster. They wind up winning the rights to the first pick. And, you know, like you mentioned a few minutes ago, now they can maybe trade that for something good, right? And what you see is the system's still broken. I mean, Adam Silver and the NBA have not found a way to de-incentivize or disincentivize tanking behavior, and they just keep rewarding teams. So I'm not sure that this change is going to have the intended effect. I mean, we saw 10 teams tanking this year down the stretch. You know, that is absurd percentage of the league. And I wouldn't be surprised at all next year if we have like 8, you know, and that's just way too many, but it's tough. I mean, I understand where these teams are coming from. I mean, if you're Phoenix, what hope do you have against Houston and Golden State and Cleveland and some other teams? I mean, the only way you're ever going to be able to match up with them is to get some super duper high draft picks and really develop those guys and have them all to come together as a nice. So it really gives these teams no other options. And, you know, it's a tough situation for the league. And they're very lucky that there are, you know, teams that are good are really, really good, because this issue of competitive balance gotten away from Adam Silver, and there's no easy fix to it.
Why can't we go back to the system in the 90s? But it was like, what? If it was the current NBA, the worst team in 13 balls for the next team, and 12 and 11, and so on. What about that? Or is it too much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're trying to weight it to make sure that the bad teams can, you know, still have a chance. You know, that would really, and it don't have like they do currently. You can definitely go too far in the other direction. Imagine if a team like Denver won the number one pick this year, right? Like, you already have this, you know, really exciting young core of Murray and Harris and Jokic, and you throw a number one pick on top of that. I mean, holy cow. But then the flip side would be, if Denver wins the number one pick, like, how bad are Phoenix and Sacramento going to be next year? I mean, it could be really, really bad, right? And they have no reason to watch. So I'm not sure what else he can do, but I think he needs to figure out some other mechanisms for, you know, encouraging these teams to win, because, you know, the way it's going right now is too many teams trying to lose, too many, you know, teams throwing no-name G League type guys out there on court late in the season. And if you're a season ticket holder, like, let's say the Memphis Grizzlies this year, how many nights do you think that those fans went home feeling like they got their money's worth? You know, right. If you pay for 41 tickets, you know, you probably feel like you wasted your money on like 35 of those 41, and that's a really precarious position to be in.
Oh, well, but it guarantees success after all. Minnesota was in the lottery for 14 years, and Sacramento still trying to recover from 2006. So, yeah, it's tough. So, that's about it, Ben. So go ahead and publicize, advertise your work. Go ahead.
You know, si.com/NBA. I mean, that's where all the writing goes. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Golliver, BENGOLLIVER. And we also have the OR podcast. It's on Apple, iTunes, everywhere else you know, you get podcasts. Just search for Open Floor.
Thank you so much, Ben. I think I owe you lunch, right?
That sounds good, man. Well, it's great to hear your voice. Hope everything's going well with you. Now, hopefully we'll talk soon.
We will. Thank you so much. Game over,
yeah! Hashtag blame Ray Ray.
Hey, Santa Faith High School in Texas and Mount Zion High School in Georgia, we're thinking of you.